I said in one of my earlier talks that my prognosis for the subsequent and future development of the labor movement was not that the solution was going to be found by organizing the unorganized, which is, all of them point out, the big problem for the labor movement, not the big problem itself. The organization of a few hundred thousand or a few million more workers is not going to make any qualitative difference. It's not going to halt this process. It's not going to impede the process. It's not going to change the character of the economy, the thrust of the increasing automation and structural unemployment. That the solution must be a political solution. The American capitalist class is confronted with acute problems, both with the revolutionary developments in Asia, Africa, and now in Latin America, and with growing competition from their friends abroad. Their policy is to unload the cost of this increasingly sharp competitive rivalry on the backs of the American working class. That's Kennedy's policy. It was Eisenhower's policy. And their commentators now in the Wall Street Journal, they say that Kennedy can and has done more for the American businessman in the 2 years or 3 years that he's been in office than Eisenhower did in his past two administrations. He says Eisenhower couldn't dare get away with what Kennedy has done. In the granting of tax concessions and concessions of all kinds, in holding down through the labor bureaucracy all attempts upon the workers of this country to protect themselves both on the job and their standard of living. The standard of living is gradually going down with the increase in the cost of living. Most of these union states have given up the only protection that the workers had, which was the escalator clause, for some insignificant or meaningless fringe benefit. The unions and the union leadership, they don't have the support of the growing number of those who remain outside the unions and find it increasingly difficult to get in because they do not represent any of their interests. All of the fringe concessions gained by the unions, and there are many, and they did it because in order to conform with certain restrictions placed upon wage advances, are confined only to a narrowing section of the working class. The overwhelming majority are shut out from medicine, socialized medicine, pensions, hospitalizations, and so forth and so on. And there is so much vested interest now in these social welfare plans, which are growing at the rate of $5 billion a year, $5 billion a year, pours into the coffers of these joint plans, that most of the unions are opposed to social legislation that will provide the same benefits for the whole of the working class, because it will upset their own little plans. Social demands? Can they inspire young workers coming into the labor force, and on what basis? Can they win friends among the Negroes? The Negroes have got to fight these people as bitter enemies in order to break down the Jim Crow barriers, the greatest disgrace of the labor movement, Jim Crow barriers by the labor skates themselves, the Negroes who fought in 1934, 5, 6, and 7. on picket lines from one end of the country to another, who have demonstrated their loyalty to the unions over and over and over again, who have remained part of the Democratic Labor Coalition, supporting the labor unions' leadership in their politics, are paid off with Jim Crow. And by God, we've got to support this fight, which is a fight, in the last analysis, to retire these people. Yes, not on the basis of their age, though, but on the basis of the fact that they're already putrefying and stinking up and lousing up the whole social atmosphere in this country. Yes, the Freedom Now Party is a threat and a danger to upsetting this whole neat little structure upon which they've based their power and their privileges, of destroying the Labor Democratic Party coalition, of above all providing the American workers, the white workers, with an example of struggle, of mass struggle in the streets. And we're materialists. We know that the political backwardness of the American workers is a relative thing. That consciousness of the necessity for political solutions and political action will find a path into the minds and consciousness of the workers, because there is no other solution. There is no solution on the basis of a job trust. There wasn't in the 20s, in the 30s, in the 40s, in the 50s, and certainly in the 60s, less than ever. You know, some people raise the question of a contradiction. They say there's an apparent contradiction between your advocacy of a Freedom Now Party and your advocacy of the formation of an independent labor party. Not at all. No contradiction at all. It is precisely through this detour, as you might say, that the development of labor party sentiment and organization will be accelerated and facilitated. It'll be this struggle by the Negro civil rights fighters, the freedom fighters, for their own political organization, which, like other manifestations of mass action, will pound through the thick skulls of the white workers and accelerate the consciousness of the necessity of doing for themselves what they see the militant Negro fighters are doing to solve their problem. That is the solution, and there's no other solution for the American labor movement. We have every confidence that the American workers, who over and over again have demonstrated their capacity for struggle, will find in time the political road which will lead to the organization of a party expressing the aspirations of all working people, and not just a thin section of labor aristocrats who think that they can get by on the basis of unloading the whole burden of the increasing crisis in the economic structure on the unorganized working class. It's our job to facilitate, to accelerate that process, and I think the comrades today, who went out and sold 176 subs, made a very important contribution to this process. I've spoken on this. I spoke a little longer than I had planned, but I had a lot to say. There's something I've been wanting to get off my chest for some time, and I appreciate this opportunity to do it. All right, we'll have some questions now.
What were the precise ways in which Taft-Hartley prevents unions from further organizing?
Well, under Taft-Hartley, for example, if you win, you got to go through the process of having an election. If you win the election, you're designated as a collective bargaining agent. But that doesn't necessarily mean the employer has to sign an agreement with you. He can bargain with you and bargain with you and bargain with you as they do. And in the process of sometimes this bargaining process takes, sometimes even recognition requires a year, 2 years, sometimes 3 years. In the process, the employer just weeds out those who are union conscious, replaces them with strike. It gives the employers the right to propagandize their employees, which they did not have under the Wagner Act. That is to have to put out anti-union material. Free speech, they call it. Free speech. Free speech. Under Taft-Hartley, the employer is not compelled to sign an agreement. And many other provisions of that nature, which, as Cope says, you know, as it gives the employer enough of a handle so that it's almost impossible to organize.
What about Kennedy's Act?
Well, that is an expansion. See, under Kennedy's Act, there were certain actions that supporting unions could take to force a recalcitrant employer into line. One of them, for example, would be to call to have a boycott. Well, the Kennedy Act outlaws secondary boycott. So that unless you're directly involved, it's a violation of contract if you don't go through a picket line. If you're another union that's not directly involved, and so forth and so on. Initiating movement for what? We don't exclude, or rather I don't exclude, the possibility that there may be a split in the labor bureaucracy if there is such a development. See, such a development will not come unless there's a tremendous pressure from the ranks for it, a tremendous pressure which it would be reflected in the top union leadership. Some union leaders may feel that this pressure is so great that in order to behead the movement, they would have to remain at the head of it, you see, and would go along with such a development. It's not excluded. It depends a lot on how much delayed they'll not take the initiative. In the sense that that the initiative will come from top without pressure from below, and it depends upon how, under what circumstances this is done. If there is a big depression, for example, which isn't excluded, nowhere is it written that this pattern of periodic recessions will be repeated ad infinitum. At one point, there'll be a qualitative change, you see, from recession into depression. This may spark a tremendous revolt within the ranks of labor. A great deal depends upon the development of the Freedom Now movement. You see, there can be no stability. There can be no stability so long as there are 20 million American citizens in revolt. Cannot be. The capitalist class cannot grant the demands of this movement. It can only make token concessions, which are not acceptable. Each token concession is taken and used as a platform for a further advance. There can be no social stability. And under these circumstances, we have already, for example, an incident in Detroit. You may have heard about it, where in the fight against police brutality, the cops killed some white kid from a neighborhood. And this youngster went down to his neighborhood and mobilized the kids in his neighborhood for a demonstration against police brutality, and then went to the Negroes for support. And say both groups went down in a big demonstration against police brutality. And where did they learn this from? Where did the white kids learn this from? They learned it from the Negro freedom fighters. You see. Say these lessons are picked up as one group picks up lessons from another. The class as a whole will pick up and begin to utilize these when they're confronted with really pressing needs. We don't exclude it, but it's not a likely variant. And as I said before, if it's too long delayed, we don't even exclude the development will take a more revolutionary form, not through a reformist labor party.
Tom, there was an article in the latest Nation magazine on called The Curious Quest of a Woman Power, which...
Yes, I read
that. What did you think of that?
Well, there's some truth to it.
Did you say what it was?
Well, that has been going on for some time now. They find that more and more women, and in some cases, they find women are more efficient than men. And some of the operation on this some of this new technologically advanced machinery, and they can be hired cheaper. And they don't make such demands. They're not as union conscious and so forth and so forth and so forth. That's all of that is true. What he overlooks, though, is that women resent this status, the so-called inferior status. And when the radicalization begins, as in most revolutionary developments, you'll find the women out in the front ranks tearing their hair off. That's what he overlooks. That the women are radicalized along with the men, just as they were in Cuba, in the Russian Revolution. In 1930.
Yes, the militants, the women led some of the most militant struggles. B's sister, Genara, was head of the Women's Auxiliary in Flint. I think we have some picture of the women with clubs busting in all the windows in that plant because they try to prevent them from getting food and stuff into their men that were sitting down inside the plant. And busting through the cops line. They're making a mistake if they think they can get away with that. Further question?
You mentioned the post-war period, how the Communist Party got thrown out of the labor movement. I think that was basically anti-Stalinism because what they did are basically a form of anti-communism because of the pressures of the witch hunts.
Well, on the part of the leadership...
Peter twice claimed, always try to excuse the... out of labor movement by saying that they were really victims of the anti-communist
regime. They were, by and large. As far as the leaders were concerned, they were anti-communists. It's true. But the fact of the matter is that many of the people who had previously supported them, many of them had been members of the Communist Party, militants, joined with these fakers against them because of the role that they had previously played. You talk about union bureaucrats. They were probably the most corrupt gang of bureaucrats that you've ever seen in the labor movement. Deprivation of democratic rights, victimizing workers and terrorizing them, beating them up. That was part of their method of controlling these unions. There's a great amount of hatred for them developed amongst the militants, who would be the natural ally of a genuine communist grouping. But the leaders were anti-communist, sure. They played on the whole witch-hunting atmosphere that developed after the Cold War.
What happened to bar trade union fractions during that period?
A lot of them were wiped out. We had a maritime fraction of over 100. But with the Cold War, And they instituted what they call a screening process. The Coast Guard is in charge of the maritime industry. And you had to, huh?
They ran a hiring policy.
The unions collaborated with the Coast Guard and the FBI in screening militants out of the unions. That is, you have to have papers. You have to have Coast Guard papers in order to sign on a ship. And if you didn't pass the security test, the security screening, your papers were lifted and you couldn't sail. That's all. And that's how most of the militants were screened out. Of course, it's a long story. Later on, there was a court test, and they had to retreat partially. Many of those who were screened out were permitted to return by virtue of a decision of the California court.
So I was
going to
say that there were several other points that made it so difficult to defend the Communist Party at that period. Some of the things they tried to institute. Auto plants, for instance, where we work. They never had peace work in many of the plants. And all during the war and then afterward, they try to reinstitute the peace work system for the workers there.
Don't use that word. You mean incentive pay.
Yes, incentive pay for the peace work, which the workers didn't want. They were the advocates of the permanent no-strike pledges, Thomas told you. They fingered every militant on the line during the war. It would turn a man that had four or five kids over to the draft board, put such pressure on you. They would hold you up in big rallies and force you to buy a war bond whether you wanted to or not. They were the ones who kept talking about working overtime without pay. And we should be ever so happy to accept the wage freeze because after all, the boys were dying. They would put pressure on the union meetings to go out and collect grease and give blood. And there was no end to what they did as far as the conditions. They would speed up on the job and set higher production standards. There was just one other thing. When Tom said that the rise of the CIO was a real social movement for the workers, you could have seen them when they poured out into the streets and came up into the halls to sign up in long, long lines waiting in the streets to sign up the cars to organize. And then when you would hear them sing, which later became the union song from the whole UAW as far as I know, and many didn't know some of the first words of it called solidarity. If you ever get beyond the first verse and read what they used to sing along with the first verse by the thousands of all over the streets, you'll hear words like that in our hands is place of power, greater than their hoarded gold, greater than the might of armies, magnified a thousandfold. And they go on to tell you in these choruses that follow after the verses that follow, that they dug all the mines in this country and built the railroads and built the city, and now they stand out cast and starving did the wonders they had made. But the union will make them strong. And you read the verses to that song someday, and you'll know when Tom says it was a big social movement they thought they would join it. They came with all kinds of problems and evictions and problems of the price of coal and every other problem the union hall, because the floor was just the union for them. There was a real change that they felt.
Any further questions or contributions? You got anything for me to sell? You can call their attention again to this pamphlet. I get 10%.
Yeah. I want to remind you that for awards lectures, you should read The Long View of History. If you've read it once or twice or three times, read it again. You'll get more out of it now that you understand something than you did the first time. Is there anything else you think they should read, George, other than The Long View? That's enough. Okay, that's not much of a burden. Remind you once again, tomorrow night's 8 o'clock, and then next three nights are 7:30 each night. Final lecture in this series of four by Comrade Carey. He'll deal tonight with the history of the development of the Socialist Workers' Party, where we left it off two lectures ago in the World War II period. I remind you that the next three nights, the meeting time will be 7:30 again. So, Comrade Carey.
Comrade Chairman and comrades, the method I've used in presenting a sort of a historical review of the development of the labor movement and of the party is to show the interrelationship between the both the objective and the subjective factor in the process. Not that they're always direct, but you can understand the development of the party only within the context of the objective situation in which the party functioned. And you can understand then the process of splits, fusions, unifications, which the party has undergone in the period since its inception, beginning with the first split from the Communist Party in 1928. Now, maybe we should review these so that you will have then some better grasp of the, I think, a question that was asked about, or rather, maybe it was a question that I posed that others have directed against us. Most recently against Ward in a debate with a representative of Science and Society, that I paraphrase, if you're so smart, why aren't you rich? That is, if you've had a correct program, why haven't you led a revolution in this country or in other countries throughout the world? And I tried to explain that there can be no revolution unless you have a revolutionary situation, that while the Revolutionary Party plays a decisive role in a revolutionary situation, it cannot make a revolution regardless of how correct you may be or how wise or brilliant your leadership may be. In 1934, as we discussed, there was an upsurge in the labor movement after the inauguration of Roosevelt and the beginning of the New Deal. And that resulted in the first fusion, a fusion between the Communist League of America and the American Workers' Party to establish the Workers' Party. Now, this fusion was brought about primarily because of the role played by the Communist League of America in the Minneapolis strikes. As we discussed before, the American Workers' Party, or as it was known then and subsequently as the Musteyites, Musty was one of the leaders, was a group that was primarily involved in the struggles of the workers for organization and of the unemployed workers. And one of their criticisms of the Communist League of America was that while we were all very competent theoreticians, and that when it came to arguing revolutionary theory, it was very difficult for them to stand up against us, but the big question mark that they placed over us, how good were you in the mass struggle? And that question was answered in Minneapolis when the Trotskyists there led the movement that organized the Teamsters and provided the basis for converting Minneapolis into a union town. It was one of the big open shop preserves of the employers in the 30s. And that satisfied at least the militants in the American Workers' Party. And of our competence in this area, and the fusion then was took place without too much difficulty. Sidney Hook left. He didn't go long into the Workers' Party, along with others, but Burnham, Musty, and a number of others came into the fused organization. Now, this led in turn to a split in 1935 with a grouping headed by Hugo Ohler, known in history as the Ohlerites, a sectarian grouping, which were very principled, And who insisted, of course, that every I be dotted and every T crossed before there could be any kind of a fusion with another organization. We were concerned only about establishing the basic principles of the movement and permitting time to develop differences, if such were to develop, and looked upon the fusion as a process of education. We had no fear about the competence of our comrades once they came into contact with the members of the AWP. The movement had been trained in combat against the Communist Party for a number of years. We had devoted practically all of our time as a faction in the Communist Party to intensive study of all of the problems of the revolution. And I might say we had some very qualified people, both in the ranks and the leadership, and we didn't see much danger in the AWP watering down our program. On the contrary, we felt every confidence that we'd be able to assimilate them and make Trotskyists out of the best of them, and we did. Now, this is a phenomena that you will witness, and we have witnessed in our party, but has been true ever since the beginning of the radical socialist movement. In fact, Engels, in the Marx-Engels correspondence, has a letter explaining why it is that at moments when the party is confronted with the necessity of making a turn, that you find resistance on the part of a section of the party, sometimes overt and sometimes covert. Comrades who become accustomed to a certain routine, who draw back from making a necessary change in their whole method of functioning and a whole view of the development, and respond often by sectarian insistence upon living up to every principle that they can cull from the texts of whatever books they've read that have justified the existence of the party in a previous period in order to oppose a change that the party has made. If you're interested, you should look through the correspondence. You'll find the letter there, among other letters on this question by Engels especially, who played a very active role in the development of the German social democracy. So far as the building of the party is concerned, probably Engels wrote more prolifically on it than Marx, who was more concerned with the theoretical aspects of the problem. They resisted and conducted a big struggle, and in the course of the fight, split from the party. And like all such groups, after they split, they had a split. Two, three splits, I think. I think their headquarters was here in Chicago. They published a paper called The Fighting Worker. And they continued for a very long time. That's another phenomenon in the radical movement, that it's the sectarian groups can go on indefinitely, it seems, for many, many years, because what happens in the outside world has no effect upon their reactions whatever. They continue if reality doesn't conform to their theory, so much the worse for reality. And when you get that kind of a grouping together, you can go on indefinitely repeating the same formulae and blaming everything that goes wrong on what's happening outside and not on your theory and practice. In 1936, we have the rise of the CIO, a continuation of the upsurge, the development of a left wing in the Socialist Party as an out growth of the effect of the victory of Hitler in Germany, the reaction, rather, to the victory of Hitler in Germany, and the beginning of the Spanish Civil War. It was under those circumstances that we executed an entry in order to fuse with the left wing of the Socialist Party and to reinforce the very small group, the very small cadre of the Socialist Workers' Party. These are all methods that the party has undertaken to build the party. All detours, if you remember, from the original objective and perspective when the party split from the, that is when we abandoned functioning as a faction and announced our beginning to function as an independent party and beginning to recruit by ones and twos. There's no great merit in recruiting by ones and twos unless you're compelled to do so. Where you see other elements or groupings developing in your direction, if you're alive to the necessity and the dialectic of building a party, you at least go halfway and three-quarters of the way, and this time we went all the way into the Socialist Party in order to fuse with this developing left wing. In 1938, you remember, by that time, the Spanish Civil War was on the verge of being defeated, if it had not been defeated, by 1938. I can't remember when Madrid fell. But by that time, it was obvious the Spanish Civil War was going to be defeated because of the false policy of both the Stalinists and the Republicans and the Socialists. And there was a certain reaction set in our struggle in the Socialist Party against the centrists and the right wing led to a split from the Socialist Party when they wanted to impose upon us the Leninist concept of democratic centralism on the left wing, not on the right wing. We said that's not quite a Leninist concept, and we refused to submit to discipline which would have compelled us to violate principle. The question of coalitionism, of people's frontism, is to us a principle. And under no circumstances can it be violated for any kind of tactic, even that so important a one as of acquiring additional forces for the party. And it resulted in the formation of the Socialist Workers' Party in 1938 and of the founding Congress of the Fourth International. I stated then that in 1938, at the founding convention of the party, there began the debate on the question of the class character of the Soviet Union. If I remember the positions presented in that convention, I think they ranged over the entire political spectrum. We had a tendency that characterized the Soviet Union as a fascist state. We had a tendency that characterized the Soviet Union as bureaucratic collectivism. We had our traditional worker state position. We had the tendency, I think, characterized it didn't know what the hell it was, and so forth and so on. It was a very lively convention. All views were given a complete, full, and adequate hearing. It was a forerunner of the fight that took place in 1939. Well, it wasn't long after the party had been established in 1938 that the war broke out in 1939 with the Hitler-Stalin pact. This had a tremendous impact, especially upon petty bourgeois radical circles in this country. Hitler, justifiably, was hated, reviled, not only by radicals, but by all people who had any sense of justice. The atrocities committed by Hitler, especially upon the Jewish people, a large part of the radical movement were Jewish, and much of the periphery around the party. The impact of this public opinion against the Hitler-Stalin pact, and especially after the invasion of Finland, infected a substantial section not only of the party but of the party leadership, and led to one of the most fundamental discussions in the whole history of the party, covering every aspect of Marxist theory, philosophy, sociology, politics, strategy and tactics, organization. Two books written on this period in defense of Marxism and the struggle for a proletarian party are two of our classics, documenting the issues, both political theory and theoretical, political theoretical, as I say, ideological, philosophical, and organizational, that arose in the course of this dispute, and was a very deep-going split. That is, the Shachmanite minority took some 40% of the party. At the beginning of the fight, they had a majority of the political committee. They were the editors of the paper and of the magazine. And they were head of the militant business administration and of pioneer publishers. They represented almost half of the party, if not more at the beginning of the struggle, and 40% at the time of the split. This was the effect that the war had upon the party and the general atmosphere of revulsion against the method, the way the Stalinist, cynical method, the way in which the Stalinists not only joined with Hitler in their pact, but the partition of Poland and the invasion of Finland and the absorption of Bessarabia and some of the other, the three, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, some of the border countries by force and invasion of the Red Army. Now, I can't possibly go into all of the questions involved in this dispute. You could spend an hour or more on any one of them, on the dispute over dialectical materialism, on the many of the political questions that were corollary to the main question of the class character of the state. I will just say that, briefly, the character of the opposition assumed that of a combination. We characterize it as an unprincipled combination because the three major leaders of the opposition held different views on what we considered the central issue in the dispute, the class character of the Soviet Union. Majority held our traditional position of unconditional defense of the Soviet Union against imperialist attack. The Abern Wing, the leaders of the minority of the opposition were Martin Abern, one of the founders of the party, Shachman, another one of the founders of the party, and Burnham, who had come into the Workers' Party through the American Workers' Party. I've been one of the leaders with Musty of the American Workers' Party, and who then became one of the leaders of the Workers' Party. Abern's position was held that the majority concept was correct, that it was Soviet Union was a workers' state. Burnham first advanced the concept of bureaucratic collectivism. There was a new form of state, and that this bureaucratic collectivism would be the next stage in the development between capitalism and socialism. That the development would take the course of going from capitalism through bureaucratic collectivism and then into socialism, as I remember it at that time. He later modified it when he split not only from the Workers' Party, but from the Shachmanites, and wrote his book called The Managerial Revolution, in which then he made an identity with fascism, between fascism and Stalinism. He said both are forms of bureaucratic collectivism, and we have to oppose both. I think he was one of the original Third Camp advocates. Shachman refused to take a position. He says this is not important, that what is important is the reality of living events. Well, how do you determine the reality of living events if you don't begin, as Marxists do, in the struggle between states, on first determining what the character of the state is that's involved in a conflict? We don't determine our attitude towards questions of war without first determining what the character of the state is involved in this war. And that was our traditional position, not ours, but the position of Marxists from the very beginning. But he refused to commit himself on this question. In fact, under his pressure, Burnham withdrew his resolution on bureaucratic collectivism. And therefore, we had before us not a counterposition on what was the major political question, but a block on the organization question. They said the important question was the regime. It was a very bad regime. They called it bureaucratic conservatism. It was conservative because we insisted upon clinging to our old ideas, which had been negated and outworn by these new developments. And the block was held together by the cement of agreement on the question of the regime. Now, we all learned a very important lesson then about such combinations, because the question immediately arises. If, for example, the combination had a majority in the party, took over a majority, and took over the leadership of the party, what would be the position of the party? Would it be Abrams' position of workers' states? Would it be Shachman's position of no position, that is the reality of living events? Or would then Burnham take his position out of his briefcase, and would the position then be bureaucratic collectivism? And it reinforced once again that departing from principled politics can lead only to disintegration. Trotsky pointed out, he says, well, you may have a lot of justified criticisms over the regime. He says, but as Marxists, we determine our attitude towards a regime by the political line it carries out. A good regime is a regime that carries out what we consider a correct political line. And a bad regime, even if they were made up of people who all loved their mothers and went to church and knelt down before three times on Sunday, would still be a bad regime, because the political line would be incorrect, and therefore it could only lead to defeat. And the determination of the regime then in the last analysis is what are its politics. And I'll show you as we go on how this same question played a role in the subsequent factional disputes in the party in different forms. Now, that doesn't mean that there can't be individuals in a regime who are rude or arrogant or incompetent, But that's not decisive, or even a little bureaucratic. But that is not decisive in a struggle over political principle. When questions involving political principle are in dispute, those are the decisive questions, and those are the deciding questions, and the so-called organization question is always subordinate to it. Throughout the period of the war, that is, I might say that when this split occurred, the opposition took the name of Workers' Party, and the name of their paper became Labor Action. Remember the paper that we published in San Francisco when we entered the Socialist Party? And they stole the magazine from us, and then we published the magazine under the name of Fourth International. Previously, it had been New International. Burnham never went along with them. After the split from the Socialist Workers' Party, he announced he was splitting from the Shachmanites because he had a principled opposition view on the whole question of Marxist philosophy, sociology, and politics, including the question of bureaucratic collectivism. The Workers' Party, the Shachmanite Workers' Party, didn't adopt a position on this question until 1941. At their first convention following the split in 1940, they introduced and adopted a resolution, and bureaucratic collectivism became the line of the Workers' Party, Third Campism. Throughout the period of the war, they entered into competition with us as an opponent organization. They published a paper. They ran candidates against us. They were going to show us how to go about building a party. They had all the intellectuals. They had all the writers. They had all the thinkers. And they were going to show us how to do it. But in the end, it was the political line that prevailed. We had some few people left who could put out a paper in a magazine and who knew something about running a party. And we continued to function and to survive while the Shachmanites ended up several years ago back into the Socialist Party, where they now constitute one of the sections of the right wing of that organization. Gave up their independent organizational existence. Because they were cursed from the very beginning. They were cursed from the very beginning by the kind of struggle that they conducted inside of the Socialist Workers' Party on the so-called organization question. And from the very beginning, Workers' Party was cursed with factional, permanent factions around the disputed political questions that had arisen in the course of our discussion. Johnson with his Workers' Party position, you had bureaucratic collectivism, you had a workers' state position. And on a whole series of other questions, they had from the very beginning a combination of factions, never a centralized Bolshevik party that had a unified, homogeneous political line. One of the inevitable outcomes of unprincipled combinationism. In 1940, our comrades were indicted under the Smith Act, and the Smith Act case became one of our major campaigns for the whole first period of the war. up until the comrades went to prison in latter part of 1943, beginning of 1944. And we were able to arouse a considerable support in many sections of the labor movement. Many very important unions, mass organizations rallied to the support of our comrades, despite the organized attempt on the part of the Communist Party to sabotage and to slander the Minneapolis defendants and prevent, where they had any influence over the union, any support to our case, for which they paid heavily when their leaders were indicted under the same act a few years later after the war and were sent to prison. And we were never permitted to forget many of the organizations that they went to for support reminded them of the role that they played when the leaders of the SWP and the Minneapolis truck drivers were indicted under the Smith Act. They never got the kind of support we got. One of the reasons for it was their conduct during the first Minneapolis Smith Act trial. In the post-war period, that is a period 1945-46, as we discussed, there was another turn, another upsurge, a big strike wave. And it reflected itself in the party by the necessity of making another turn. That is a turn to the mass, a turn to the mass movement. And your sub-drive of yesterday reminded me of the activity of the party during the 45-46. If you'll read back in the back issues of the Militant, you will see that in that period, the quota for our sub-drives were around 22,000 subs for a three-month campaign. We were selling 25-cent introductory subs, but I don't think that was the difference. There was the beginning of a radicalization, and again, in that period, most of the subs were sold to Negro people. The greatest response were in the Negro areas. In fact, in New York, I was organizer of the New York local at the time. Through the sub-campaigns and a subsequent study group that we organized in local, we built a Harlem branch of about 100 people in 1946. Now, the peculiarity was that there was not the kind of movement there is today among the Negro people. It was part of the general radicalization reaction of the working class against the restrictions imposed upon them by the war that brought them in. Now, one thing we could not do, we could not hold them, because with the beginning of the Cold War, a reaction set in. The beginning of the long period of prosperity reaction. And we could not give them action. We were a small group, primarily a propaganda group, a group that is attempting to gather together a cadre of revolutionary socialists to build an advance guard capable of appealing to more advanced workers, but not capable of substituting for the institutions and organizations of action which then existed. The situation now is much different. That is, now you have a radicalization among the Negro people. You have a big movement, a fighting militant movement. The working class is passive. And unfortunately, on this question, by and large, reactionary. Now, at one time or another, there's going to be a conjuncture of a radicalization of the working class together with a radicalized Negro mass, and then you will be in a pre-revolutionary situation and sell a lot more subs than you did yesterday, I'm sure. Not only that, we'll grow to the point where we'll begin to actually lead mass actions of a militant character, either directly or through our participation in the action organization. Now, here again, there took place an internal struggle in the party. This time it had a twofold character. Strangely enough, the radicalization gave rise to a proposal for a reunification of the Socialist Workers' Party and the Workers' Party, the Shachmanites, on the part of a number of people in our party and a number of people in the Workers' Party. We proceeded in good faith to welcome any step in discussion of the possibility for a reunification, and found that instead of having been advanced seriously, it was advanced as a maneuver in an attempt to split off a grouping in the Socialist Workers' Party. Now, unity maneuvers are very bad things to fool around with. And when you do, you usually get burnt. But one thing you've got to be serious about, it's this question of unification. You can't maneuver with the question of unity, as they found out. We entered into the unification discussion in good faith, and we found that, as I say, discovered was a unity maneuver by virtue of the reaction that occurred when the discussion began. Now, when you go into a unity discussion with a tendency that you feel is coming closer to your views, and you feel that there is a possible area sufficiently wide in agreement to establish a unified organization, there are certain preliminary signs which indicate whether or not you are serious. In your public press, for example, you don't begin attacking the other organization that you're discussing unity with. You don't begin vilifying the leadership.